We're uniquely moral. We're this unique force for good in the world. We're, you know, the greatest force for good that has ever existed in the history of the world. And this is a governing idea that it, if you're a politician, you can't actually deny it. Otherwise, you lose. You're attacked for denying our exceptionalism, that we're these this exceptional people. But nonetheless, despite all that, we are, you know, one of the things we're exceptional in is violence. I mean, we've been at war with large segments of the world for almost every year of our history. So I'm not really sure that the risks of conflict are up, because we are constantly engaged in conflict. You know, and the obvious ones are most recently were the invasion of Iraq, for which there was no provocation, no justification, at least in terms of just war theory. So is there an increased chance of conflict? Well, we've been at conflict a lot. Now we find out that there are American soldiers in sub-Saharan Central Africa, Niger. But with that said, I think this is it's a more dangerous time, because we seem to be taking a very aggressive stance towards Iran, pulling out of a nuclear deal that I think was a major step forward in terms of more Pacific relations between the United States and Iran. And there's a great deal of provocation directed at North Korea and the North Korean nuclear program, to the point where I'm worried that there could be a miscalculation. If everybody's rational, you're not going to fire a nuclear weapon, right? Because it means your total destruction in, as a response to that. But something could go wrong. You know, people could act irrationally, or they could perceive the situation to be such that they would need to. And the Trump administration has been very belligerent, to the point that, you know, they, I'm not convinced that they wouldn't launch a first strike, and I think a lot of people have the impression that they'd be willing to.
Actually, on climate change, some sort of war is being waged between the rest of the Western countries and the rest of the world, in a way, and those who kind of deny this. Now, we're here in Texas, and oil industry plays a historical role, and that's one of the three major energy-producing states of the United States. Mm-hmm. Are people aware here, or how often do you see here the notion that climate change actually doesn't exist and is an invention of some
research? Quite a bit. It's usually the way it's presented, because it's very clear that major oil companies know that this is going on. It's very clear through some recent revelations that ExxonMobil knows that climate change is for real. But there has been a concerted effort on the part of the oil industry to fund research, and I put research in scare quotes, directed at denying, or at least casting doubt upon, climate change. So you do have a number of institutions like the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which are funded by the oil industry for the sole purpose of casting doubt on claims regarding climate change. And the normal strategy is to say, we don't know. Not that it's not happening, but there's doubt, there's a debate, we don't know. And to demand equal time, and to paralyze the political system through, you know, basically casting doubt on the science, which within the scientific community, there's no question anymore that this is happening. This is a well-established fact, as much as anything can be under in these kinds of sciences. So Donald Trump in that respect is an outlier, because he claims it's the Chinese. But the ground has been prepared for Donald Trump by this constant droning beat, you know, drumbeat of climate denial, or at least climate doubt, that comes out through Fox News and talk radio.
Now, what's the checks and balances, if we look here, Beaumont, on a local scale? I hear about the cancer belt, belt historically. Also, this is a kind of, there have been obviously a past already in that. I have been out yesterday in a field smelling all of this. And you wonder, in Europe, in Germany, there would be environmental groups or associations to kind of take up. Here I have the impression it's rather a taboo question mark. Is it a taboo, or is it just because those who are feeling the negative consequences are at the same time part of the whole industry?
I think it's some of it's the latter, right? That people who feel the consequences are part or work for the industry and their livelihood is built up in that industry. Part of it is some of the worst violations tend to be geographically located in minority and poor communities. So if you notice around here where you have the refineries, the area around here is not particularly well to do. They're not going to position the refineries in places that are well to do. Now that's not entirely true because there are some other areas that are better off than this particular space. But generally much of the worst environmental damage is done or is inflicted upon the poor and minorities who have the least political power. So I think it's a combination that many of the people whose livelihood depends on this, but who also feel the effects of it, are not willing to stand up. And the reality is over the last, you know, 3.5 decades, ever since Ronald Reagan, the institutions that could provide a check on corporate power, namely unions, have been systematically dismantled. So the traditional working class organizations have been subject to a major assault, starting with the Reagan administration, and have been decreasing dramatically in terms of their membership and their capacity to affect any kind of change in the political scene.
Yeah.
So that check is being removed. And that's also part of the growing inequality. I think the entire Western world is subject to growing inequality. But we are really well advanced compared to continental Europe because of the loss of the working class organizations and the inability then to resist the demands of capital.
You say you feel yourself as belonging to the group of Sanders voters and feeling some sense of what. So how ready is the United States for a change out of the current social and economical model?
Well, that's a good question. I voted for Clinton in the general election, and I voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary. I kind of go way back with Bernie Sanders, but I actually campaigned for him when he first won election in 1990 to the House of Representatives in Vermont. But I have to admit, I was a little bit nervous during the primaries because I thought, I just don't know if he can win in a general election. I think in retrospect, he would have won. I think we are, and part of what makes it look like populism is that we're in an anti-establishment mood. Throughout the West, there is just a general dissatisfaction, major dissatisfaction with the way political institutions and economic institutions and the way that the political and economic establishment has been working over the last 3 decades. And I think Bernie Sanders caught that mood. If you look at the polling evidence, you know, on issues, most people actually agreed with Bernie. And he came off, unlike Hillary Clinton, as being quite authentic because he's been saying this for, you know, 45 years. He's been saying the same thing and hasn't really changed with the times. That might be seen as a bad thing, but he hasn't been opportunistic about what he said.
But with Bernie Sanders, there would be more of state programs, also health care and social programs.
Yes.
And if I listen during my trips here through Texas to a lot of people,
there's a lot of skepticism about that.
A big divide, especially if I hear Trump voters. So at the same time, this capitalism is in crisis in all the Western world. And what reforms do you see here? What is possible, and what would be needed to overcome this crisis?
What I think part of it is rolling back changes that had been made over the last 35 years. To me, the core problem is the domination of our discourse and our policy making by what I'm not sure what you call it in Germany, but over here what we call neoliberalism. an emphasis on privatization of economic activity, of liberalization or deregulation of economic activity where it's not privatized, an emphasis on austerity, government cutbacks, increasing incarceration of sort of malcontent elements or unruly elements. So there's just been sort of this assault on the traditional sort of social democratic structures of the welfare state that protected people and the institutions that sustained those structures in terms of unions. There's been a real steady assault on that. So what would have to happen isn't initially, and I think Bernie captured this, a questioning of that neoliberal orthodoxy that we've got to privatize, we've got to deregulate, we've got to cut taxes, we've got to cut spending, all of which falls on the backs of ordinary people. Because when the spending gets cut, it's really the programs, the welfare programs, the social welfare programs that they benefit from that will be cut. You know, in the process, what we've seen is, and we saw this clearly in the financial crisis, a sort of privatization of profit, but socialization of risk. So profits flow to those few who are in a managerial or ownership capacity with respect to finance capital, but the risks don't. The risks have to be borne by all. So when banks fail, they get bailed out by the government.
We have the same debate in Europe, mm-hmm. Especially with since Piketty's capitalism mm-hmm. in the 21st century. Yes. So the result is what? That the those who are in wealth have to be taxed higher and especially from top to down? Or does it need to be more international contracting mechanisms? Because single-sidedly, a state in alone cannot solve or undo the neoliberalism.
I mean, that's always the argument, is that we've... individual states, nation states, are really no longer can stand up to market forces. This is why, I mean, I have and still have some hope for the European Union, that if they could break out of the grips of this sort of orthodoxy, because it's an accumulation or a confederation of states or federation of states, it would be better capable of standing up to international capital. Some of it's going to have to be cooperation among governments, clearly. Some of it is going to have to be renegotiating trade deals. Because the reality is the states are not powerless, right? Corporations still need to be located somewhere geographically, and they still have to be located somewhere legally. And so it is possible to have an impact on international corporations through law, through state activity. They're not existing outside this world, above it, and can move entirely at will. They are subject to law. They are subject to geography. They do benefit from public investments. And so I don't think states are powerless. I think that it is a difficult issue. They no longer have quite the same degree of power that they once had, say, in the immediate post-war period. But they are not powerless nonetheless. In the case of this country, with Bernie, one of the main issues where we differ from the rest of the developed world is the lack of universal health care. And I think that, ideologically, that battle's been won. Now, whether we can get a policy imposed that will, you know, consolidate that victory, but it is now accepted by the broad public that everyone has a right to health care.